Hey, welcome to the Film Podcast. I'm Ricardo.
And I'm Eric.
And we're here to talk about Canon Films. This is our third installment, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Of the Canon Film series. We've been discussing the Canon Film production company. And we're trying to hit all the big ones, all the big films. Well, we're trying to do most of the films. There's some hard to find ones that we're kind of skipping. But for the most part, we're on the money. We're trying to do all of them. We are in our first episode. We did, let's see, what did we do? First episode was Enter the Ninja, The Apple. God, I'm going by memory. New Year's Evil, and then one other one.
Did we do Death Wish 2 and Treasure of the Three Crowns? Was that the first one?
Let me see. I'm pulling up right now. I should have been more prepared. Sorry, guys.
But, and then the second one was Hercules, that championship season, 10 to Midnight, and Last American Virgin.
Yes, you're right. Dead on. So this is our third episode. Today we're going to be discussing Revenge of the Ninja, Bolero, Exterminator 2, and Breaking.
Yeah.
Man, Breaking is like haunting me. The thing is that like I just love the fact I won't spoil anything. I will wait till we talk about that movie to talk about my favorite part of that movie, which is a fleeting moment in the movie, but I loved it. All right, so you want to just jump into it?
Actually, before we get started, I wanted to mention that if anybody out there doesn't know, there is a documentary being produced about the Canon films. It's called Electric Boogaloo, The Wild Untold Story of Canon Film. It's being made by Mark Hartley, who did Not Quite Hollywood and Machete Maidens Unleashed. And they have a Facebook page, and they have just recently posted images from some of the interviews that they've been conducting. So they talked to Lance Houle, the director of Missing in Action 2, and the executive producer. He's also executive producer of 10 to Midnight. They've talked to Sharon Kahn, who was Menheim Golan's assistant on the Delta Force, to Ed Pressman, who's the executive producer of Masters of the Universe, my 80s movie girlfriend, Catherine Mary Stewart, who, of course, was in The Apple.
Yes.
Talked to Jerry Satzenberger, who is the director of Street Smart, and a whole bunch of other people. They just have some not really updates on what's going on, but they have great photos and let you know who they've been talking to and interviewing. It looks like they're up to, let's see here, about 26, 27, let's see, 30 interviews. And I saw that Albert Pyun is actually posted on his Facebook page, which you should also follow, that he's going to be sitting down with them, I think it's this weekend, to talk about the films that he made for them. So,
oh, nice.
So that project is moving along nicely. So
yeah, I've been waiting for that project for a while now. I thought it was for a while. I thought, oh, it's probably done because I had heard about it such a long time ago. But it's kind of had a slow start. But I'm excited about it. So
yeah, it sounds like it's rolling along and that it's getting closer and closer to being on our screens. So
yeah, I'm excited. And I think Alamo Drafthouse is producing it, isn't it?
Quite possibly. I would not be surprised at all.
Yeah. All right, so we'll jump right in, talking about 1983's Revenge of the Ninja. I'll give you a little bit about it, and then I'll throw it over to you, Eric, to give us a synopsis. So Revenge of the Ninja came out in 1983. It's a sequel of sorts to 1981's Enter the Ninja, that was directed by Golan. And Revenge of the Ninja, this installment, was directed by Sam Furstenberg, and he will be coming up a lot in our coverage of these films. He did a ton of movies for them. He did Revenge of the Ninja, Ninja 3, which we're going to talk about in the next episode, which I'm really excited about. I love Ninja 3. It's an erotic ninja tale with mysticism.
And it's on Blu-ray.
Yes. So if you want, pick that up, watch it, so you could kind of follow along to the films we're watching. And then, well, actually, by the end of the episode, we'll give you the next films we're going to be watching, so you could kind of be watching them as we are. So Sam directed, like I said, Revenge of the Ninja, Ninja 3, Breaking 2. And then he did one of my favorite movies, yes, of all time, American Ninja, with one Michael Dudikoff. Avenging Force, American Ninja 2. He did, what else did he do? Delta Force 3, American Samurai, Cyborg Cop. Oh, man, he did a lot of stuff for them. So I'm excited. But okay, why don't you give us a little synopsis of Revenge of the Ninja?
Okay, so Revenge of the Ninja starts in Japan with our main guy, Shoo Kasugi, and I'm not even going to pretend that we need to know what his character's name is.
Yeah.
Because in all these films, he's Shoo Kasugi. he's at home. Ninjas attack his family. He survives along with his son and his either mother or mother-in-law. From there, they immigrate to Los Angeles, which is actually Salt Lake City, standing in for Los Angeles. And he sets up an art gallery with this American friend of his. From there, hijinks ensue involving, you know, I guess plot spoilers on a 1983 movie is, you know, whatever. But so there's a drug smuggling thing and an Italian mob. I mean, this is a ninja film, right?
Yeah.
You go to this movie to see ninja stuff.
Yeah.
You want to see the weapons. You want to see the martial arts. You want to see people being badasses.
You want to see, you know, the different ways ninjas kill people. That's what you want to
exactly
see.
Exactly. So he's in the United States, supposedly L.A., with, like I said, the mountains in the background. And runs afoul of a organized crime mob family. And they, you know, the usual kind of revenge ensues, as the title says. And from there, we get to see a whole bunch of ninja stuff. And there is a, you know, there is a blonde bimbo girlfriend, and there's a betrayal, and then there's a, you know, couple of epic ninja battles. So
it's funny. Was this the only movie? Was he dubbed? Was Shoo Kasugi dubbed in Enter the Ninja? I don't remember. I don't think he was.
I don't remember.
But he is in this one. In Revenge of the Ninja, his voice is dubbed. But then by the time like Pray for Death came out and all the rest of the big, you know, by the time Shoo Kasugi became like quote unquote like a household 80s name, they would just use his regular voice. So
yeah,
this was a little hard to watch because of that. I think
he made a bunch of these ninja films for Canon, and then he was also on the television show The Master.
Yes. So yeah. It's funny, before I watched this film, I was really confused between this one, because they have a very kind of similar plot line between this one and Pray for Death. Have you seen Pray for Death?
Yes, I have. I actually saw it on VHS way back in the day.
Me too. I still own it on VHS, but I love Pray for Death. I genuinely love it. I think it's one of my favorite Shoo Kasugi films.
It's honestly been so long since I've seen it, but I have good memories of watching it, so, and I do look forward to revisiting it.
Yeah, but you know what? I think Pray for Death, I'm searching for it, and Pray for Death is actually not a canon film. I was totally surprised by that. They both, yes, have a very similar plot line where he has to leave his home and come to America and stuff. His son plays his son in the movie, Kane Kasugi, and this movie, so we know the plot line. By the way, we're going to spoil all the plot lines for all the movies we talk about today.
And I will just say that the plot lines in any of these movies don't really matter.
No.
They are the most generic plots. They're the revenge for the family killing, the revenge for a friend killing.
Yes.
You know, the sexual betrayal. Exploration. Yeah.
All you need to know. It's just, what is the hook of this movie? Like, what is the main thing they're doing? Oh, revenge. Ninja revenge. Okay. Erotic thriller. All right. You know?
Yeah.
And this one, like we said, it's a ninja film. And I guess from my notes, they couldn't, they were going to get charged too much for permits and to shoot in LA. And they didn't want to get all the permits and insurance and all that stuff. Because, you know, hey, who wants to deal with that, right?
Yeah.
So they talked to, I guess the film commission in Utah had just started, right?
Yeah.
Around that time, I think. And they talked to them and they're like, you know, we're going to waive all the fees. You know, you guys don't need to pay for any permits. We'll give you a bunch of tax, you know, incentives. Just come film over here. And yeah, certainly enough, they win, and it was supposed to be L.A., but sure doesn't look like it.
Well, you can see the Rocky Mountains, and you can see Utah license plates all over the place if you look.
They're like, why bother changing the license plates? That's going to cost us some money. Let's not do that. It's funny. One of the scenes features the character of Kathy and Kane, who's show's son.
Yeah.
She kind of is put under a spell. Like, so the Brandon, who is played by Arthur Roberts, he's kind of like the main villain of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he puts a spell on this girl, and she kind of she becomes a villain when she's kind of a romantic interest in the beginning, and then at the end. But for a while she goes like rogue because this ninja puts a spell on her, which I love, because it's kind of like a precursor to Ninja 3, which is a lot about mysticism and stuff. So she has there's a fight scene between Kane Kasugi and Kathy, played by Ashley Ferrer. And first of all, what I noticed is that she's not wearing a bra. So, like, that's the first thing.
She's not wearing much.
No, she's wearing like she's in the dojo, and she's like she's waiting for the kid, and because the kid's the one who like, so basically they have an art gallery where they have like these like very expensive like Japanese like dolls.
Yes.
And Kane knocks over one of them, and exposing the fact that the gallery owner, Brandon, is using the gallery as where he sells and launders money. You know, he sells drugs.
It's also he's using the art to smuggle ship heroin, because you know, putting the heroin in the doll makes complete sense for some reason.
Because you fool the authorities that way, you know.
Exactly.
So she's put under the spell, and she's got to kick Kane's ass. And Kane, how old do you say he is in this movie? He's about
ten, somewhere in there,
like preteen.
And
the first thing I noticed, was the fact that like, whoa, like this is as close as you come to her being topless in front of this kid.
Yeah,
like really.
Well,
close.
You know, there's something weirdly sexual about the whole encounter between them.
Yeah, it is like they're like, hey, we couldn't really put in a lot of sex scenes, so we're gonna make the fight scene with a kid kind of sexy. And so she's fighting like in what could kind of be. Like, I wouldn't go out of my house if I was a woman when I was wearing this stuff. Like, it's like a tank top that's like really, really tight and really, really short shorts. Like, really.
Well, you know, this is the 80s, and it is Salt Lake City. So there you're more likely to get harassed by, you know, prudish Mormons than your, you know, date raping or whatever, you know, street gang in LA or New York.
Yeah. So they have a fight scene, and man, it's a pretty rough fight scene, like for it being a kid and a woman. Like, she beats the shit out of him. Like, she of course it's stunts and stuff, but I mean, in the context of the movie, like, she's beating the shit out of him, and like,
oh yeah,
he gets some good kicks in there and stuff, but it's a pretty good that one by far is a fun fight scene, just because of the fact that it's a scantily clad woman and a little kid. That's what makes it fun.
He gets two or three fight scenes in the film, and they kind of have a weird tone, because the first one, he's at the park with his grandmother, and they get
bullied.
He gets attacked by these bullies from school, and you know, he's wearing his blue jeans, and he's got a pink Izod shirt that lets you know it's 1983. And his baseball cap, and they take the baseball cap away.
Yeah.
And then he kicks their ass, and it's almost like a Marx Brothers kind of a thing. I mean, it's pretty rough, but there's kind of that kind of chaotic comedic tone to it to a certain degree.
Yeah.
You know, you almost expect like the Looney Tunes like sound effects or whatever. And then he has this weird fight with the woman who's scantily clad, and it's like, whoa, what's going on here? I mean,
when the first time he has a fight with the kids, I also noticed that he's wearing a Dodgers hat, and I wonder how how do they deal with like getting? Do they have to clear that with the Dodgers, or I wonder do they not
they
care?
Might. But, you know, this is like 1983, so who knows how sophisticated that is.
Yeah, I was wondering that. Also, later on, we're gonna eventually get to Bloodsport, and he's sporting Giants hat and jersey, mm-hmm. but not the same Giants. But back to this movie. he's wearing his Dodgers hat, and they kind of knock it off his head, these bullies. And they start harassing him and his grandmother, and he just beats the shit out of them. And
oh, yeah.
Another thing I noticed was the bullies are usually, for the most part, I mean, I was born and raised in L.A., California. And mm-hmm. For the most part, you don't see a lot of mixing of races when it comes to gangs. It's usually, you know, like, hey, this is an African-American gang. This is a Mexican gang. They don't really kind of that the group of bullies were like, which was they're kind of like they're the beginning of a gang, basically.
But well, once again, they're a Salt Lake City gang, you know, yeah, it's all the minority
yeah.
kids.
Yeah. So it was a group of like different minorities. Then which I dig. It's like, hey, you're giving everybody a fair shot in this gang. but yeah, so he beats the crap out of them, and then he beats the crap out of the scantily clad woman. Besides some of the cool like 80s fight scenes, there's not a lot you need to know about this movie. The fact that they dubbed his voice kind of threw me off a little bit. Just because I was already used to just hearing his voice. But spoiler alert, his friend turned out to be the villain.
Not his friend. Yep.
Turns out his friend was not his friend. the end fight scene is a rooftop fight scene in the daytime. Yeah, well,
before we get there, you know, there's a bunch of stuff involving various ninja weapons. And, oh, yeah. you know, the yeah. grandmother gets a fight scene involving a different kind of a doll that she uses as a weapon that's kind of cool.
Her fight scene is interesting because clearly it's a stunt double.
Yes.
It doesn't even, like, the stunt double doesn't even have the same shape as the grandmother. Like, it's, mm-hmm. but it's a pretty comedic, that one's definitely a comedic fight scene.
Oh, yeah.
I was definitely, well, I had a few chuckles at that.
And also, between the point at the beginning with a couple of fights and the big fight at the end, the Italian mobsters, who, by the way, are, like, the most stereotypical Italian mobsters you'll see in any 80s film.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they might as well have had spaghetti falling out of their pockets. they send a gang out to rough him up, and this is also an integrated gang where there's a, you know, a Native American, and it's just, you're like, you know, it's this equal opportunity. Did somebody go down the checklist and be like, got an Italian guy, got a Native American guy,
yeah,
got a Japanese guy, of course. I mean...
It's an ongoing theme in the 80s bad guy repertoire. You know, like if you yeah, like if you look at the Wraith. Do you remember the Wraith? All the villains.
Oh, yeah.
You have like Ron Howard's brother. What's his name?
Clint Howard.
Clint Howard. Yeah, he's part of the gang. He's like the nerdy gang member. You have like a punk rocker. You have an Asian American. You have the tweaker, and then you have like a black guy. Who was kind of like punk. So a lot of the 80s movies deal with this, where they're like, you know what, we're not going to discriminate against our gang. If you're a bad guy, hey, come join us. Let's kick somebody's ass.
I blame The Warriors, which is a movie I love. But, I love, you know, The Warriors. You think about the gangs in that movie. And,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, so there's a lot of stereotypes in this movie. You know. The drug lord. I mean, no, sorry, not the drug lord. The Italian mob boss. And there's some pretty cool ways the ninja kill off their villain. Like, there's a scene where a guy opens a door and he like blows like what are kind of like not darts. They're like little like almost like nails onto his face. Do you remember that scene?
Yeah,
that's pretty.
Yep. Yeah,
pretty gruesome. But yeah, there's you're what you would expect out of a ninja fair. There's not much. This isn't one of my favorite ninja movies, but it was fun to watch, you know, his take on it. I know he didn't want to direct the director didn't want to direct the movie like your typical ninja movie, and he kind of approached it from the interviews that I've read with him, that he wanted to do it. he approached it like an American action film. So definitely, you could definitely tell that, it wasn't like Enter the Ninja or any previous ninja movies. It definitely had a different spin to it, and it was interesting. It was interesting take on how he directed it and stuff. Just the fact that he shot it in the day. The final fight scene takes place in the daytime. A lot of the ninja stuff takes place at night, you know, under the cover of night and stuff. But it was kind of bold that he just went out and was like, hey, fuck it, I'm going to film my movie at night, in the daytime.
This also has very much a Western feel, you know. I mean, we keep talking about Salt Lake City, which is the West. It's about an immigrant who flees home country, comes to America to start over, start a new life.
Yeah, and he vowed not to fight anymore. Remember, he had vowed not to.
Yes.
And you know, when spoiler alerts, when they kill his mother, you know, all bets are off.
All bets are off. Yeah.
And it took me a while to, when I watched this movie, to be like, oh shit, this is what I thought was from this movie was actually from Pray for Death. So
okay,
I was a little confused at first, but yeah. Again, both those movies are very similar, but I think if I'm going to recommend a movie, even though it's not a canon film, I'm going to go watch Pray for Death. It's a much better film, and they're much cooler death scenes and stuff, and much better fights.
It is, but I will say I have the DVD of this. I have is like a 3-pack with, I want to say it's American Ninja and... I'm totally blanking what the other film is. So, I mean, it's like one of those 3-packs you can get for like $10-$15. So, you know, this isn't a huge investment and you can just put it on in the background. I do want to say that one of the things I noticed is now having seen a lot more Hong Kong and Asian martial arts films from the 70s and early 80s, the fight choreography in this is fairly clunky.
Yeah.
So,
a lot of the punches, you could definitely see that it totally missed, you know. It's like they're swinging at air.
Yeah,
maybe part of that is fight choreography, but also part of it is like camera placement and stuff like that. But hey, it's 80s and it's really fun to watch. I'll give it that. It's a really fun movie. Yeah. So is there anything else you want to talk about this film?
Let me take a look at my notes here real quick. Oh, the bad guy wears a big silver mask that reminds me of Destro from the G.I. Joe.
Oh yeah, It's like the silver like mask. Does that? It has kind of like reddish eyes from what? So,
there's a bum who gets killed in slow motion in a fountain.
Yes,
and that reminded me of the Omega Man.
Yes, totally.
And there's a couple killed in the hot tub in what's kind of a sexy erotic thing, but it's also got a certain kind of slapstickiness to it that, like I said, the tone for this can be kind of all over the place. It's, you know, you have kind of wacky fights and then you have some serious fights and then, you know, you have some emotional moments with family members dying and it's kind of all over the place, but I don't think that the tonal shifts really sink it at all.
Yeah.
I really think this is a movie that was made for cable for you to catch like half of in the middle of the night or throw on in the background and not worry about.
Oh yeah, definitely. And like I said, this is the second installment. There was Enter the Ninja, then there's this one, which is really has nothing to do with Enter the Ninja, by the way. Nothing at all. None of the characters besides a show, Kasugi, who plays the villain in Enter the Ninja. Mm-hmm. That's all they have in common. And of course, you know, Golan producing, but
yeah,
that's about it. And then the third installment will be Ninja 3, the
Domination,
and we'll be discussing that in our next episode. But definitely, out of all of them, Ninja 3 is my favorite. So watch that because it's if you think they get crazier as they go,
yeah,
right. Like it's like Enter the Ninja wasn't bad. Like it was like your typical fair ninja movie. Then Pray for Death, it was like whoa, it got a little crazy with the girl with the boobs almost hanging out. And then part three, like full-on like erotic ninja thriller.
Demonic possession, dance, save the wrecks. I mean, the whole thing.
Yeah.
So I will say this, that, you know, Enter the Ninja, I think, was kind of a surprise hit on probably cable in the end of the drive-in era and then eventually on VHS and home video.
Yeah.
This made like $13 million domestically in the United States. Now, I'm assuming that's box office.
Yeah.
It's saying it's box office on the Wikipedia page, But this was something that you definitely saw at the video store.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So I'm sure this movie made a lot of money. And so they thought, you know, these movies are making some money, so we can continue to do these. And as we talked about in the last episode with that championship season, a lot of these movies financed those movies, financed movies that were, you know, more highbrow or based on plays or were trying to say something.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, which, successful or not, you know, you have to admire that, hey, we can make some popular popcorn stuff, put some money in the bank, and be able to make some passion projects.
And the thing about these movies is that they have good, I mean, I saw this when I was a kid, and I must have seen it when I was a teenager, and then I rewatched it for the podcast, but it didn't, at no point was it a chore to watch, you know, where other films on the list will be like, I have a hard time getting through them, but this one is definitely fun to watch.
And it's 90 minutes long, and even points that get a little boring or whatever, it's not like if you walk away or check your email or something, then you come back to it that you've lost the plot thread or you don't know what's going on.
There's no plot thread to lose.
Exactly. That's the secret. There you go.
And like I said, like these were all B movies from the 80s, and the difference between this stuff and what Asylum is doing now, you know, like where they're kind of, they're making like B movies, is that these, like, they weren't making a shitty movie. They were just making an exploitation. You know what I mean? Like, it was just like, it was just them like, hey, we want to make a ninja movie. Fuck it. We're going to make it. We have the money. Let's do it. Where a lot of the Asylum films feel like it's like, hey, this is a movie you could sell to sci-fi. So let's make this, you know, let's make this formula.
The thing is that everybody here knows we're making a fun popcorn movie.
Yeah.
Everyone got the memo. Everyone knows that this is not going to be high art. And it's also, but you know, they show up and they do their job, so it's not like they're like, oh, the title sells the movie kind of a thing.
Yeah, and everyone, when it comes to these type of movies, if a couple actors aren't on the same page of what type of acting it is, it could really throw you off, because you're like, oh wow, these actors thought it was this movie, but then these other actors, they're in a completely different movie. Yeah. But no, everybody knows their place. Everybody knows, you know, what they're making, and it makes for a fun movie. I think it's fun. Like you said, it's a good thing to just, if you're throwing a party, just put it on in the background. It's fun. You're going to go back to it. You're going to like, oh, what the fuck's going on? Why is this kid fighting this girl with the nipples showing through her shirt? And then you'll put up the volume and watch that. And then, you know, back to your party.
Speaking of her, she'll show up at least one more time on our series here.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Good looking girl, by the way. All right. And I, like we said, the last battle takes place during the day, and I thought it was pretty bold of him to film a ninja fight scene, like in broad daylight outside on the rooftop. I heard it took forever. There's a lot of interesting, like, helicopter shots and crane shots up there, so he definitely tried to spruce up that fight scene, and it turned out, I mean, as well as it could have, you know, it was fun.
Yeah, and you know, one thing else I do like about these kinds of films is you know it's shot in a hotel in Salt Lake City, so you see what a 1983 hotel corridor looked like.
Oh yeah,
you see, you know, the street shots of what people were driving and people were wearing and what the streets looked like. And, you know, this is something I think we talked about before, which is you get a snapshot of a time and a place, even when that's not the point of the film.
Oh, yeah.
And that's often nice to see.
And I want to make that comparison again to the Asylum film, because that's besides, like, the trauma film and stuff like that, the Asylum films are, I think, as close as we're getting to a modern version of that. But when you see the, like, Sharknado movies and stuff, you know, well, there's only one. When you watch Sharknado,
there's a second coming, but yeah.
You don't get a feel of like, oh, these people were out shooting the streets. It feels like, hey, they took a bunch of money, they went to Canada, and they just filmed this movie. Where with some of the Canon films, you definitely get, like you said, it's like a little time capsule of what, you know, they're really filming on the streets. It's not a soundstage.
Oh, yeah.
It's just them really filming on the streets. So you get a little taste of what it was, you know, in 83 in Utah. And so.
Yep.
Yeah. So I definitely would say, this one's one you should watch. I definitely speak out for the ones you could skip, but this one I say watch. As usual, we usually do a Letterboxd rating. If you don't know what Letterboxd is, if this is your first episode you're listening to, there's a film social media website called Letterboxd. It's really fun. You know, you don't have to see cat pictures or anything like that. It's just fucking movies. Just people who love movies, talking about movies, saying what movies they watched or rewatched. You could review them. You could rate them.
You make lists.
You can make lists, which is fun. That's the fun part. And it's Letterboxd, LetterBoxd. And so it's just Letterboxd without the E at the end. And it's a really cool website, and I like to support them because they're a cool, they're a fun website. So,
and I actually keep the list of the films we're watching for this series on Letterboxd. I have a public list so you can see what we've covered.
Yep.
So, and for myself, this year I started keeping my record of what films I'm watching this year on, as a Letterboxd list.
Me too. Well, I'm doing the diary as the films I'm watching this year.
Yeah, and I have both. I'm doing the diary, and then I have another one that's films watched in 2014.
Yeah, so follow us on there if you want. And it's totally free. So sign up, it's free. Yeah. You can link it up to your like Twitter, and you can find us really easily. So check that out. But what is your Letterboxd rating that goes from half a star to 5 stars?
All right, I gave this 3 stars. And once again, this is not Citizen Kane or Touch of Evil or anything amazing, but I just thought it was fun, and it was, like I said, a snapshot of a time and a place, and there's some nostalgia involved, and it's 90 minutes, and I just had a good time with it. So it did not bore me, and that's the most important thing when it comes to exploitation films.
Yeah. I followed your lead. 3 stars. It's fun. It still gives me time. Gives me a place to go when it comes to other ninja movies that are going to be coming up in the episodes. So 3 is enough. It's like you said, it's not boring. It's fun, and it's one you should watch. I definitely would say, out of all the canon films, this is not what you want to skip, because also you want to get that whole the ride of Enter the Ninja, Revenge of the Ninja, and then Ninja 3: The Domination. So you see how wild they get. So.
Well, you also see how the filmmaking and production level evolves over time.
Oh yeah.
You see them start with, this is their tentative steps into the marketplace.
Yeah.
And not only that, you see, we can spend more money or less money on things, and we also have to remember that, Enter the Ninja was 81, and this is 2 years later. In 2 years later, the home video market is leaps and bounds farther along than it was in 81. And so is the cable market, as far as stuff like HBO and on TV and all kinds of other forgotten stuff. I mean, that's where these things really were being seen.
Yeah, totally. That's the first time. All these ninja films, I would go visit my grandfather, and he had all these films. This, Enter the Ninja, he had, like I said, that's where I first saw like Pray for Death, which is, again, I can't recommend that enough. I love Pray for Death. That's where they made their money, VHS.
Yeah.
But all right, so we'll move on to our next film. So I gave it 3 stars, so did Eric. And then we're moving on to...
Before we jump to our next film, in the release schedule of films, following Revenge of the Ninja was let me find my place
over
here.
Over
Brooklyn Bridge, which is not available, which, this is a film starring Elliot Gould from 1984, and it's sounds like it's kind of a Jewish-centered romantic comedy or dramedy set in Brooklyn in the 80s, and I'm not sure why this isn't available. First of all, Elliot Gould is kind of an amazing actor, and at least in the podcast circles I travel in, a lot of his stuff is currently being rediscovered.
Yeah,
well, and people are,
and someone who just passed away, but is also in this movie, Sid Caesar is in it.
Oh yeah,
Burt Young. It's one of the movies where when we got to the list, when we were discussing this episode, I was like, oh yeah, I definitely want to check out Over the Brooklyn Bridge, and then couldn't find it anywhere. at all.
And apparently Sarah Michelle Gellar is in this.
Oh wow. Oh yeah.
It says that she's the daughter. At any
Yeah.
rate, I just you know, if we can get on our soapbox here for a moment. Like we said earlier, you know, a lot of films like Revenge of the Ninja made money so that they could make these kinds of films
Yeah.
that had like a personal connection, or they wanted to say something, or they, you know, in this case, maybe they wanted to make something for their community. And I think these films need to be out there so people can go back and look at them. And it doesn't necessarily need to be like some, it doesn't need to be a Criterion release.
No, no.
You know, give us the, you know, the $10 multi-pack DVD with a decent transfer, and we're going to be happy.
Yep.
And especially when you look at somebody like Sid Caesar or Elliot Gould, you know, Shelley Winters, Carol Kane. I mean, look at this cast. You know, these people have fans, and they're you know, their fans want to go back and see these films. And, you know, we're in the day and the age of the Warner Archive model where give us the burn on demand option for this. Give us the streaming option for this.
Yeah, yeah. So. Like, I would definitely, this is a movie where if it was available on Amazon or any video on demand, Vudu or anything like that, I would have definitely shelled out the, you know, $3 to watch this movie. Because I had never heard about it until I started doing the list to this whole canon list. So it's definitely a movie I would have loved to have seen. And this hell, the cinematographer to that movie is the Terminator cinematographer, and he did Near Dark. Okay. So just for that alone, I want to see it. So yeah, so I would love for a streaming service to kind of, you know, pick that up or something. Hopefully.
Alrighty, so now that you've had that public service announcement,
yeah, and we'll keep talking about that because there's a lot of movies on here that we are not able to talk about because they're not available to us. So.
Exactly.
All right, exactly. So we skipped over the Brooklyn Bridge because we couldn't find it, and that leads us to 1984's Breaking.
I'm just gonna ask you, when was the first time you saw this film?
I was a kid. I must have been, yeah, I was born, I must have been like 5, 6 years old when I first saw this.
Right.
It didn't make any sense to me, by the way.
Well, it didn't make any sense to me when I watched it last fall, but I mean, let's be honest here that, you know, this once again is not a film that's about the plot or what's going on, but this was released in May of 1984 when I was 10 years old. And I remember it playing at our local theater that was like 4 blocks from our house. Didn't see it. Didn't see it on cable. Never saw it on video. Never really had any interest. Of course, I heard about it. But I didn't see it until last fall when we were talking about watching it. And so, you know, I know that there's certain things with my generation that I'm way behind the curve in seeing, and this is one of them.
So I watched it when I was a kid, because it was just it's one of those movies that is like popular, like it just like kids would be like, hey, have you seen this movie? And so you'd go out and see it. But I mean, I had no interest back then, and I'm not gonna lie, it was a little bit of a chore to watch. It was hard to get through. It's one of the ones that I'm gonna definitely say, look, it's definitely referenced in a lot of jokes in popular culture. So I'd say see it if you have any interest in comedy. but it's hard to get through. The only thing that got me through the beginning, and then it was all over after that, is the fact that you see Jean-Claude Van Damme as an extra in this movie.
Okay.
And that was enough for me.
I was just say that, you know, this is not a great film. But I could see that if you – let's say you're my age, that you're a Gen Xer, and that you have, you know, a 12, 14, 15-year-old who's into the Step Up movies or any of the current dance movies, and you want to show them something from your youth, you can sit back and you can laugh at this.
Yeah.
Or if you're getting together with a bunch of friends and remembering all those stupid things we saw as kids – put this on. This is not something you're going to sit there and go and think about what it says about life or the universe or anything like that.
No, but here's the thing: is that I wouldn't want to play this movie at a party, just because it's like it's so fucking weird and not cool at all. Like,
yeah,
it's not even like kitschy cool. It's like, for, well, at least for me, I know a lot of people, I'm going to alienate a lot of people. People are like, so funny and fun and you're stupid. But I just, maybe because I'm not into dancing. I feel like if I was into dancing, maybe I'd love this movie for yeah. what it is. But,
well, and let's talk about the plot real quick. Yeah. And I'll just summarize it as it's a classically trained dancer who gets interested in what's going on with dance in the streets.
Yeah. It's Save the Last Dance, the Julie yeah. Stiles film, basically.
Basically.
Yeah.
And the cast is kind of interesting. You've got Lucinda Dickey as the young jazz dancer, and we will be talking about her with Ninja 3 The Domination.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You've got, I can't even pronounce this guy's name. Adolfo
Quiñones?
There you go. Thank you.
Yeah.
And Michael Chambers as the break dancers.
Yeah.
You get Ice-T as a MC. You kind of see him in the background.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got Christopher McDonald as, is he the agent, as I recall?
Yeah, he is, yeah, yeah.
If you don't know who Christopher McDonald is, he's one of those character actors you've seen in so many things, it's not even funny.
He's a Shooter McGavin.
Shooter McGavin, of course. He was actually, and I will stand by this, he played the Robert De Niro character from Midnight Run in a series of TV films that are worth watching.
Oh, I totally forgot about that. You're so right.
They're not amazing, but they're totally worth, you know, an afternoon.
Yeah, I guess if you love Midnight Run and you're like, man, I'm itching for more of this, they're worth it. They're worth it. They're worth your yes. watch.
Especially the first one with Kathy Moriarty and the guy who was the dad on Arrested Development, whose name I'm totally blanking on.
Not
Jeffrey Tambor.
Jeffrey, yeah.
Okay, and he was also, and probably what I think is his greatest moment on screen ever, he's the dad in SLC Punk.
Oh, you're right.
Another one I forgot. His son just totally goes off on him about what a sellout he is, and he says, remember, son, I didn't sell out, I bought in.
Wow. So. Yeah. I forgot. Yeah, he's had some really memorable roles, but he's such a good character actor that he just kind of he does what he's supposed to do, is he blends in. He blends in and he does his part and he's amazing and he's great. He's great in this. It was fun, like I said. It's fun watching these old movies and then seeing like people doing bit parts and that later on went to do, you know, leading roles and stuff. But
well, he might actually be the best actor in this film.
Oh, hands. Well, wait a minute. He's definitely the best actor with speaking parts, because Van Damme.
Yes.
Van Damme is in it. Okay.
Well, okay. And I'm talking about the acting, the performance, the delivery of dialogue, all of that stuff.
Yeah, no, he's definitely the best actor in it. But yeah, like I said, man, besides the funny dancing peppered in, not a lot of plot here to hold on to. There's nothing for me to like push besides the fact that during, I think it, which is the first street dance number, you literally see Van Damme dancing in like a leotard shorts.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just dancing there and you're like, what the fuck is Van Damme doing dancing? But besides that, I can't recommend this movie. Not with a clear conscience.
it's a curiosity.
Somebody
needs to chop this down to like a 45 minute YouTube montage or something.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
Hit the highlight.
Yeah, it's funny. I was just listening to an interview that what's his name? Topher Grace was giving, and he was saying that he had been a producer on a movie, and as he went into the editing suite, and he asked all these things of the editor. You know, can you do this? Can you make this longer? And then he watched the cut of it with his notes, and he's like, wow, I made the movie fucking worse. So as a editing exercise and you know, to know what that side of filmmaking is, he's taking like films that already exist and he edits them and he re-edits them in a different way. He famously did Star Wars Episode 1, 2, and 3. He did it as one movie. And I'd like to see somebody take a shot at that, like that. Like, just kind of re-edit this movie and see what they can do with it, because it is fucking hard to watch.
Well, you know, and I think also this is a movie that, while the kind of Save the Rec Center, the rich girl and the street kids story had been done before, you know, they were trying to come up with the formula of how this would work for the 80s. And let's face it, the movie's called Breakin'. This is a showcase for breakdancing.
Mm-hmm.
This is a showcase for showing middle America, some, you know, this dance style that had caught on the coasts, and you know, like any other dance style or craze or fad, you know, this is something that they thought, oh, this is new, and kids, you know, kids in Minnesota and Iowa are going to go gaga over this.
Yeah.
And or they're going to hate it, one of the two. But
well, they didn't think they were going to hate it. They're like, they're going to eat it up.
This will piss off their parents.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, like you said, like, this isn't anything that we hadn't seen before. This is Saturday Night Fever. This is Dirty Dancing, but with breakdancing. This is Save the Last Dance.
I'm sure if you go back to the 20s, there's a version of this.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in some ways, you know, I know you're not a big musical fan, but one of my favorite musicals is Gold Diggers of 1933, and that's the let's put on a show so we can pay our rent, you know, movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's nothing new.
Yeah, totally. But, yeah, like I said, for me, it was just hard to watch, but I know if you're into dancing at all, like in any way, shape, or form, it would be cool to see, like, hey, what were the dance moves of the 80s? Yeah. And this is it. And the director, Joe, what's his name?
Silberg.
Yeah. He did a lot of these Canon Film dance movies. He did, we did this, Breaking. He did Lambada. He did another one, which we'll maybe cover if we could find it, called Rappin'.
Rappin's available.
Yeah, is it? Rappin'. No G.
Rappin'. I'm sorry. I'm pretty positive that Netflix has it. So, okay. Yeah.
Rappin'. He did, what else? Lambada. And then I thought he did another dancing movie, but I may be mistaken. But yeah, so Joel, he loved the dancing movies.
Yeah.
All right. So anything else? Any other notes you have?
You know, I really didn't take a lot of notes on this one, but I'm just going to say that, you know, this was also around the same era as Flashdance, which I think maybe dealt with some of the same ideas in a better way.
Mm-hmm.
And as cheesy and not engaging as this is, it's definitely a cultural artifact. I mean, of once again, that time and place.
Yeah. And what did you rate it?
I gave it 2 stars.
2 stars.
I mean,
too generous.
Yeah, maybe a little bit, but you know, there's a certain amount of, you know, like I said, just nostalgia for the time and the place.
Yeah. I gave it 1 star. Based on Jean-Claude Van Damme. That's it.
Okay.
I just gave it to him. So that is 1984's Breakin'. And then we skipped 1984's Sword of the Valiant, The Legend of Sir Gawain and the Grey Knight.
Once again, not available.
Not available, and it's one that I'm interested in seeing because it stars Sean Connery,
Peter Cushing.
Yeah. So Miles O'Keefe. I was interested in seeing this, and then couldn't find it. So thanks.
Once again, this is a sword and sorcery flick. Yeah. Let's with Miles O'Keefe and Sean Connery. Let's get it out there on a 4-disc set of some kind with a decent transfer and let people see it.
Yep.
You know?
And then sadly, a one I really wanted to cover, and maybe so I could definitely find. Okay, so the next one we skipped, but I really want to cover because I'm a fan. But it's 1984's Love Streams. It's a John Cassavetes film that he did with Canon, and I was really jazzed about this because this is where, like you said, all these exploitation films paid for the movies that weren't going to make money. Like this one, like that Championship Season, like Over the Brooklyn Bridge. All these, that was kind of, he's one of the guys I would say about Menahem Golan is that he's one of those guys that you know how a lot of people say, hey, I'm going to make one for the man and then one for me. He definitely kept that promise to himself, where he definitely made these exploitation films, but he definitely, that dream he had about making legit films, I mean, they produced this one, Love Streams, which stars Gina Roland, John Cassavetes, Seymour Cassell. So I was really jazzed about it. Can't find it. I found like a bootleg copy of it, but I hate doing that because I just don't like doing that. I'm hearing a friend of mine. I have a friend who kind of, you know, he's an actor and he's. Who I want to get on this podcast, and I think I think he paid a lot of money to get a copy of this movie. So I'm hopefully we'll do an episode. Hopefully, maybe we can get a hold of some of these if any of our listeners know anybody who has VHS copies or something.
Yeah,
if we can get a hold of some of these, maybe we'll do the lost films of Canon Films. So
well, and I would say of all the ones that we've talked about or seen go by already, this is the one that's most likely to get issued by someone like Criterion based on the fact that it's a Cassavetes film.
Yes. And I won't lie, I started watching the bootleg version, and just from the first couple minutes, I was in. And I was like, I fucking want to watch this movie, but I don't want to watch it on fucking YouTube. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's one of those movies where I didn't want to watch it on the small screen. I wanted to watch it on you know, on my TV. So I'm going to wait till I can get a hold of an actual copy, a DVD copy or something, or a VHS copy. If somebody has it and wants this, you know, fuck it. If you want to let us borrow it, we'll return it if you want. And maybe we'll do at the end, we'll do an episode of the forgotten films that we couldn't find. But we'll skip that for now and we'll move on to 1984's Bolero. This one I'm excited to talk about. Because it was so bad, and I loved it. Let's start off with the synopsis right away. Give us a synopsis.
Okay.
Already.
I'm just going to read this straight from the Wikipedia.
Okay.
And I'm laughing at the plot is described as Ari Mac McGillivray, Bo Derek, and we're just going to call her Bo Derek from now on. A virginal, young woman, on graduating from an exclusive British boarding school, is determined to find the right man for her first sexual encounter wherever he may be in the world. So she goes to Europe. Rich enough not to venture forth alone, she brings along her friend, Catalina, who's infinitely more hot than she is. And the family chauffeur, Cotton, who's played by George Kennedy, of course, another amazing actor.
Yeah.
Bo Derek travels to an Arab country where she meets an ideal lover, a sheik who offers to deflower her but falls asleep almost immediately. Giving up on the sheik, she goes to Spain where she meets Angel, who manages to stay awake. Unfortunately, after she succeeds in her quest, Angel is gored while bullfighting. Blah, blah, blah. Do I need to talk anything more about this?
No. Hey, look, it's an erotic film.
It's an erotic film.
Quote, unquote. Okay.
All right, I'm gonna be the pig now and say, so you know, Bo Derek is famous for being the California blonde at 10. Do you find her to be a 10 and as attractive as she is being promoted to be?
No, it's funny because no, she's not. So she's fresh out of boarding school in this film. So I mean, boarding school is like, it's high school, right? You go all the way to the end of, right? So she's supposed to be 18, 19. I'll give you 20. She was 30 at the time when she filmed this movie.
The other thing is that exclusive, you know, British boarding school is supposed to turn out, you know, either thrill-seeking, you know, miscreants or, you know, refined ladies, and she comes off like a California bimbo.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. So, okay, let's go through. This movie is so awesomely bad.
Go for it.
So this movie starts off, and she graduates boarding school, and for some fucking reason, George Kennedy's there, who's kind of like her Alfred, right?
Yeah.
Because her parents are dead. It's like an erotic Batman, but instead of revenge, she wants to fuck the world. So
she just wants to get laid, yeah. And I'm like, what? I mean, seriously, come on here.
So, like, it's that hard for a hot chick like that to get laid, right? So, yeah. So George Kennedy is there to pick her up, and he's been her like caretaker slash chauffeur slash confidant slash she. George Kennedy is Alfred, like what Batman? What Alfred is to Batman?
Mm-hmm.
Cotton, which is his character's name, is to Bo Derek. So he's like the all round guy, you know, protector, driver, everything, butler. So he's there to pick her up from boarding school graduation, and he's out there, and she comes out, and, you know, in her cap and gown, and she's like, "I got to do one thing, Cotton, before I leave," and she like strips off her top, and like she like runs off topless, and that's how the movie like opens up. I'm sorry. The movie opens up with, aren't they watching Rudolph Valentino film in the beginning?
I think so. I'll be honest. I was so bored with this film, but I refer to it as Borlero. I mean, the best thing about this film, I think, is, well, not the best thing, but one of the best things is actually Roger Ebert's review of it, which is something that everyone should look up.
Is it pretty funny?
It's pretty good. He okay. gave it. I'll pull back the curtain. He gave it half a star.
Wow. He went with half, huh?
Yeah.
He took a star and he broke it in half. Gave it
exactly.
So there's a couple things I want to talk about. I have a bunch of notes for this one.
Go for it.
So she's kind of in love with Rudolph Valentino, who she calls Rudy. And she wants to find that the Rudolph Valentino of her life and to take her virginity and stuff. And oh, and I should say that Elmer Bernstein composed the score for this.
Yeah.
Specifically the love scenes. And
I hope they paid him well for that.
I hope it was a payday for him because, yeah. So it's written, directed, and shot by, he DP'd this well.
Oh, God.
By John Derek, Bo Derek's husband at the time.
All right. Do you know who John Derek was married to? Do you know who his wives were?
No. Who were his ex-wives?
Okay. Ursula Andress.
Oh, wow.
In like 1957 to 1966.
The good years.
And Linda Evans from 1968 to 1974. Wow. And then Bo Derek.
Wow.
And I don't know his first wife, Hetty Bears. I don't know her at all. She was a Russian-born prima ballerina. So, I mean, this guy was married to some of the most...
beautiful.
Yeah,
sophisticated,
well,
sophisticated people.
You know, Linda Evans, yes. Ursula Andress, yes. Bo Derek, I don't know.
No. You know what's so funny is that a friend of a friend who I know dated Bo Derek. Maybe 10 years ago.
Well, you know, I'm sure she's a perfectly nice person no, or whatever.
But it's just weird because my friend's friend, mm-hmm. he was only a little bit older than I was. So it was really weird. Yeah. Anyway, so back to the movie. This movie was nominated for a Razzie.
A lot of Razzies.
One thing that I noticed is that So they go off and they're like kind of like somewhere in the Middle East, and that's where they meet the Sheik, who falls asleep. Yeah. But like the Sheik is like white. He's not like, he doesn't look Middle Eastern at all. He looks like a guy from like the Midwest. Like he's like a blonde guy. And then so she moves on and they go to Spain. So they're traveling the world looking for the perfect guy to take her virginity. And so they go to Spain and they find this this like bullfighter type angel, and she's kind of in love with him and like, but he kind of has like a girlfriend and this weird like orphan girl who kind of follows him around, who's kind of dirty but then they clean, like Bo Derek cleans her up.
Well, you know who that is, right?
Yeah. It's what's her name?
It's Olivia Dabo.
Yeah, who is like a very successful voiceover actress and a very successful, I mean, character actress.
She's a great character actress. Yeah. She was on The Wonder Years, and I just recently rewatched Kicking and Screaming.
Yeah,
which is one of my favorite films from the 90s, and she's so good.
For the people out there, not the Will Ferrell version, the Noah Baumbach film.
Yes, exactly. I'm sorry, I should have made that clear. Not the sellout second version, but the original.
Somebody's like, you watched the Will Ferrell Kicking and Screaming? What's going on?
I've never seen that.
Yeah. Does she, anyway. Wait a minute. Does she play the sister in The Wonder Years?
She was the older sister.
Yeah, that's right. So she plays like this orphan girl that they kind of like adopt
in a weird way.
Yeah. And like there's a lot of nudity with her. But I did the math and she was only 15 when she filmed this.
Yeah, and she's older than me, so I mean.
Yeah, like but I mean not her character. No, like the actress.
Oh yeah.
So I don't know how they got around that, like, because there's...
It was Europe.
Is that what it is? Yeah.
I think so. You know, her parents were, like, hippie artist types, or I think her dad was in the Manfred Mann band, so, I mean...
Oh, wow, yeah. Because I was like, whoa, there's, like, three really, like, long nudity scenes where she's completely topless, and I'm like, whoa, like, this girl's, like, 15. What's going on in this world? But here's some of the things that happened in the movie. Okay, one, they smoke opium, which is for no good reason. Like it doesn't push story forward, or it just they're smoking opium for some reason. There's like a weird second sex scene with her and Angel, where like he's like biting her, and I didn't get that. Like wait, I don't understand. Like why are you mad? Like a lot of this movie didn't make any sense, but
yes,
it was still very. Funny. It was a really funny movie, and it wasn't fun to watch, but it definitely made me laugh the whole way through, unintentionally. And I think from what I hear, this is what kind of this was the last movie that Canon Film did with MGM as the distributor, because Bolero got an X rating, and he refused to cut anything. John Derek refused to cut anything from the movie. So this was the last movie they distributed for Canon Films. After that, MGM kind of like left that partnership with Canon, and Canon started distributing their own films again, like when they first started. But anyway, that's a little trivia. What else? I don't understand. So she's with Angel, and like. He's like waiting. Okay, so spoiler. Her and Angel kind of like are gonna like hook up, but he gets like gored by a bull, and he's out of commission, and during this time, like the Sheik comes and kidnaps her because he loves her. I don't understand that.
Fell asleep, so I don't know.
So he still wanted a boner, and so he kidnaps her and he puts her on a plane. On a biplane, he gets in there and he flies away with her, and then like she's in the plane and she's like, "No, I'm in love with this guy, Angel, and I can't go with you. I'm so honored that you would choose me and would kidnap me. That's how much you like me, but I like Angel." And then she kind of like it looks like she jumps off the plane, but then it cuts to she's back at the like at Angel's house. So I'm like, how the fuck did she jump off the plane?
Yeah.
That was a lot of this movie is unexplained. A lot of this movie is just like you don't even know that.
The last part of Roger Ebert's review, where the last paragraph he says, "Let's face it, nobody's going to Bolero for the plot anyway. They're going for the good parts. There are two good parts, not counting her naked ride on horseback, which is the only scene in the movie that had me wondering how she did it. The real future of Bolero is in the home cassette rentals, where your fast forward and instant replay controls will supply the editing job the movie so desperately needs."
Yeah, I'll agree with you. I mean,
Roger had it right on, you know, nail on the head right there.
Yeah. So I won't go on. There's a lot of things that don't make any fucking sense.
Yes. Can I just read through my notes real quick?
Yeah.
It says 1% is in the 20s. Bo Derek can't carry a film. Was this hot in 1984? Is this satire? I mean, this is the notes I'm writing down. Is this Eat, Pray, Love, Vomit 1984? This is a big tease. Her friend is infinitely hotter than she is.
Oh, yeah, by far. Yeah.
Is this really Miss 10 can't get laid? Is that kind of supposed to be a joke? Let's see what else.
Really?
Yeah.
That,
you know?
That's the only, like, he kind of hit the nail on the head. Like, her writing, wow, this is not meant to be a pun, but her writing bareback on the horse. is like what you go to the movie for. I assume that's why you buy the movie. And of course the two sex scenes with her, which the last sex scene with her and Angel, I keep like reading in all the notes I found online and stuff that wasn't simulated, that they actually had sex. That's one of the reasons they got an X rating. Don't know if it's true.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Which is weird, 'cause her husband was directing it. So that must have been really weird.
Yeah. Well, he was a weirdo, so I mean.
Yeah. So, no need to talk about this movie anymore. It's just a weird movie. But if you want to see a lot of Bo Derek's boobs and her riding bareback on a horse, check it out.
As I recall, she was in a lot of Playboy back in the day.
Yeah.
So
you
have that option as well.
You do. I would say there's no need for you to watch this movie. Here's the thing.
Yeah.
If you were saying, okay, you have to watch this or Breaking again, I'd watch Bolero again.
Yeah, I might watch Bolero again.
Although
it is long, though. It is.
It is unnecessarily long. like cut some of the movie not making sense and just put another sex scene in it, and hey, we'll be okay with that, you know.
This is yet another film that somebody needs to edit and put up on YouTube as the edit, or put up wherever as the edit.
Yes. And then there's a weird like sex scene with George Kennedy and like Angel's, like, she's kind of like the lady is like kind of his caretaker, like Angel's caretaker, slash like not like his mom quite, but like kind of like a nanny, but he's like a grown man and she's not that old, so it's really weird. But there's a weird, like, they don't show a full sex scene, but there's definitely it's pre-coitus with George Kennedy and this lady. But I don't know what George Kennedy was doing in this movie. It must have been a payday,
cash and paycheck.
Yeah. He must have been like, hey, I just need to get out of the country and make some money. But besides that, I'd say no need to watch this. I mean, when are you ever in a mood for an adventure and ecstasy, as the movie poster says?
You know what? And I am absolutely sure, even though I've never seen it, that the first Emmanuel movie, by all accounts, will take care of what you need.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, come on. We live in the day and age of internet porn and plenty of, you know.
Yeah.
The 90s was filled with erotic thrillers.
But maybe Ebert had it right, you know, like this was a great nudie pick for the 80s, you know. There was not a lot of accessibility, especially, like, think about this movie. This movie comes out of VHS and you live like in middle America, you know, and like there's not
all
a
right,
lot
of... So that's a perfect segue. I do live in middle America. I live in Michigan, smack in the middle, you know, the middle of the upper Midwest. Mm-hmm. I remember going to the first video store that we rented at that wasn't like the electronic store sold the VCRs that also rented, but the actual first rental store. And I remember seeing that this in the case, because in those days you had, you know, they kept it all under lock and key, and you had like a little tab or something that you took up to the counter. And right across from the counter with the register was, I think it was like visible by the clerk, Bolero was in the case there, and I don't remember what it was next to, because I think stuff was fairly randomly placed. But I definitely remember seeing the cover and knowing that, oh, that's one of those movies I'm not allowed to watch.
How old were you at the time?
Oh, I was probably 10 or...
Oh, okay.
I was a little older than that. I was probably... So this came out in 84. I was probably 11 or 12 when I was seeing this at the video store. So...
Yeah. It's funny. I remember, like, as a kid, like, once I turned, like, 15, probably 14, my dad kind of got me my own, like, video store card, you know? So he didn't have to go with me for me to rent a movie, you know? Like, I had his consent. And my video guy didn't give a shit. He would let me rent any movie I wanted. So.
Well, as I recall, you know, it was by the time I was, you know, 15 or 16,
yeah.
I was able pretty much to go on my own. And, you know, when I was 18 and I would, you know, because I was in high school when I was 18, senior year, and we'd go to the video store and my friends would, like, be like, hey, I'm going to go back in the adult movie section and you're 18, so you rent this. And I'd be like, okay. You know, we're kind of, you know, that hey, we've got to rebel against the man or whatever.
Yeah,
so,
totally. But these are the movies you saw before adult movies. So maybe that was the purpose of this movie. But now it holds really no purpose to me. Like, it was funny. I had a hard time sitting through Breaking. This, I was just laughing the whole way through. And then, like, it's funny because I was watching it in like, my office, and my girlfriend would walk in, and she'd be like, what the fuck are you watching? Like, 80s, an 80s erotic movie? What's going on here? And I'm like, no, it's Bo Derek. Don't worry. And she's like, what the hell is George Kennedy doing in this weird movie?
No need to watch this.
What is your rating for this movie?
I gave it 1.5 stars.
Me too.
Mainly,
like, dead on.
Mainly because I found the... I like the Olivia Dabo bit, and I like the redheaded gypsy woman, and I liked her friend.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, yeah. 1.5 stars. Hey, if you're really bored, I'd say watch it, but there's no need to watch this.
If you're a completist, if you want to laugh at what you're, you know, what men in the 80s drooled over, I wouldn't even bother. You know, I guess if it shows up on cable or something and you got nothing else to do,
It's hard to justify recommending this movie. It's really hard to justify.
You know what? If you're a film student and you want to know how to make a movie that's not erotic and overlong
and it's funny,
this is an object lesson.
Yeah, yeah.
Other than that, you can pass.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So then that leaves. What else? Let's see. That concludes Bolero. Mm-hmm. And then we will go. Did we skip any other movies? Bolero. Nope. Right on to 1984's Exterminator 2.
Yes. Okay. So you didn't actually get a chance to watch this, right?
No, I'm just gonna go on the adventure.
Okay.
In the fact that you watched
the original, though, correct?
Yes, I did. I did.
Which is not a canon film, but. I don't recall having seen the original, so I kind of want to hear what your thoughts on that were.
Well, okay, so I definitely watched the trailer for the second one.
Yes.
And Exterminator 1, like, was like a gritty kind of, okay, so it felt a lot like Death Wish did, where it was just a guy kind of taking the war to the streets, you know? And and it was gritty, and it was a little kitschy because it was made in the 80s, but it didn't have that tone, you know? Like, yeah, you laugh at some things because hey, that's you're looking at 80s stuff that's kind of funny now, you know?
Yeah.
But even that, like, I feel tell me if you feel the same way. I feel really guilty when, like, I watch something and it wasn't supposed to be funny, and it isn't done. And it isn't Bolero, and it isn't like Breaking, and I laugh at like somebody picking up a rotary phone or something, you know? Yeah. Like, there's a part of me that kind of feels weirdly guilty about laughing at that. I don't know why. I don't know what it is in me.
Do you laugh at that because it's quaint and kitschy, or is it because in my case, I laugh at that because it's something I remember and can identify with. It's nostalgia for me.
See, I'm a couple years younger than you, and
yes.
Maybe I'm laughing because it's kitschy, and I don't feel good about it. I don't know why.
Okay, well, you know what? I look at it this way, that you know, art or entertainment is supposed to provoke a feeling from you of some kind.
Yeah.
And if the attention, you know, the intention was to create something, you know, dramatic and deep, and it winds up being funny. That you're getting a reaction. I mean, that's what you want. The worst thing, like I said earlier, the worst thing a film can do is bore you. The worst thing it can do is not affect you at all.
No, yeah, you're right.
You know, and like I said, I haven't seen the first one, but my impression is yes, that it's very much like a Death Wish film that's kind of gritty, and it's got that kind of 70s New York feel, even though it was made in what, 80 or 81?
Yeah, it was made in 80.
Okay,
But
so
it
that.
definitely still had that like you said, like that gritty kind of escape from New York. It was dark, but it wasn't kitschy. It wasn't really an exploitation film per se. It
Okay.
felt more like genuine. Like he, to me, de to me, it felt like he was definitely he wanted to say something. You know, there was a message
Okay.
there. And in fact, the original one's called The Exterminator, and then with the
Yeah.
sequel, they just went Exterminator 2. That's it.
Okay.
So tell us, give us a little synopsis of part two.
Okay, so part two follows from the first one, and the main character, Eastman, played by Robert Ginty, who I'm going to talk about in a bit, is walking on the streets of New York, and he meets up with an army buddy played by the great Frankie Faison, Chief
Yes.
Burrell for all you Wire fans.
Yes.
He was also in the remake of Cat People as a New Orleans detective, and I mean, just great character actor.
Yes.
And started who owns a garbage truck, and Ginty starts working for him, and there's a woman that he falls that he's involved with, and there's a gang led by Mario Van Peebles as X,
Yes.
who he runs afoul of, and they attack him and his friends, and attack him and his woman, and she's a dancer, and they attack her in the park, and they cripple her, and it turns into a revenge film. So that's kind of, they kill his friend, they damage his woman, and it's a Death Wish film, basically.
Yeah.
This one has a really weird tonal problem in that sometimes you have that gritty 70s Death Wish revenge, and sometimes you have the kind of more camp, 80s, colorful gang thing that we were talking about earlier going on, and it kind of goes back and forth between these two tones, and it's really jarring and weird. It's got some, I'll give it this. It's got some good performances. It's got some good character actors. It's got, cameos by Ari Gross and John Turturro in small roles.
Oh,
It's
wow.
got, like I said, Frankie Faison is in it, and
Is
I like Robert Ginty.
Frankie Faison the guy in The Wire that says shit? Is it that guy?
No, that's. Oh, I forget that actor's name, but that's Senator Clay.
Oh
No,
yeah.
Frankie Faison is the chief of police, Burrell.
Oh
He's the
yes. Okay, okay.
gentleman, the
Okay.
gods will not save you. You
Yes.
know,
Yeah.
there's a there's you know he's a like I said, he's a great character actor, and I think he does a lot of stage work on the East Coast.
Okay.
So it's got this weird kind of tonal thing, and sometimes it feels like a 70s film, and sometimes it feels like an 80s film, and it kind of drags in the middle a little bit. But basically, we got a vigilante with a flamethrower, and then he's got
That's what it boils down to.
yes, and then there's a big fight at the end, and Mario Van Peebles is the bad guy, and he's kind of chewing the scenery, and there's the whole like cult kind of thing going on with his gang that's kind of reminiscent of the gang that Stallone fights in Cobra. And it's a weird movie. And let's see, what have I got here? All right, first of all, 2, 3 minutes in, you've got a J&B spotting, J&B whiskey, which pops up in all kinds of movies. You can clearly spot it 3 minutes into the film. It's supposed to be New York City, but it feels a lot like LA. You
Yeah.
got these psychopunks. It's like the gang from Death Wish 2 revisited in a lot of ways.
Yes. Oh, again, back to that theme where it's like they're like,
Yeah.
we'll let anybody in this gang.
Yeah. There's, they're walking around in these like abandoned warehouse lots with torches, and let's see, they go to this club that's stuck somewhere between the 70s and the 80s. It's like a, it's like somebody said, oh, we need some disco stuff. Oh, we need some new wave stuff. Well, let's put them together. Let's see. Yeah, Mario Van Peebles looking like an extra from Mad Max. There's like it's, it feels like an early rap video. There's a couple of soliloquies that you just think, really, what's going on here? Let's see.
Well, let me tell you a little bit of what I got from, and you know what? I think this movie I saw when I don't know, as a kid.
Okay.
But here's the thing about Exterminator 1, and then I'll make the comparison to 2. Like
Okay.
Exterminator 1 feels like Death Wish 1 and like First Blood, you know?
Yeah.
Where he's got a grittiness and like something that they're really trying to say about, you know, post-traumatic stress and all this stuff, and the same thing with like Death Wish 1, where he definitely wanted to say something about crime in New York at the time, and you know, like
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
it was a really it took itself really serious, and you know, for it had a reason to. And then Exterminator 2 feel from what I remember and from what the little bit I saw feels a lot like what exactly what Death Wish did, Death Wish 2 did, was just
Yes.
go really kind of exploitation and over the top, and hey, let's just take all the good parts of part one and do that throughout the whole fucking movie.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah, it is. It's I like to think of Death Wish 1 as being the crime-ridden streets of New York in the 70s, whereas Death Wish 2 is the crime-ridden streets of LA in the 80s.
Yeah. And you know what? To a certain extent, it happened with like Rambo 2, with Rambo First Blood Part 2,
Yes, yeah.
where I mean, and I think Rambo did really well because it didn't go kitschy. You know, it went from a serious movie about this guy kind of trying to search his role in America. And then part two went like, hey, fuck it, just fucking shoot everybody up, you know? And but I feel like Exterminator 2 and like Death Wish 2 kind of didn't, they didn't, they were just going for the buck, man, for the action buck,
Yeah.
and really they kind of left all story and anything really resembling like a message, and they just like they're like, we don't care for message, we're just.
Well, I'm looking at the Letterboxd page for this movie, and somebody named Kayla Starr has a great review. It just says, "Flamethrowers, hair gel, bad guys, impalement, boobs, suspenders, X, roller skating dude, body glitter, 80s dancing, and revenge." And that pretty much hits all the high points.
Yeah. I mean, she just rattled off things.
I mean,
I love it.
it's
Yeah.
like, well, and that's kind of what this film feels like. It feels like all these random things. And I guess at the end of the day, my note is that there's some nice camera work, but and there's some nice ideas here, but it's kind of a mess. It feels a little bit overlong. It's something that could have used another edit or two. This is a film that's really, like I said, it's the tonally is kind of all over the place, and I feel like it should have been more actiony and it should have been a little tighter, but I'm really kind of torn as to, I mean, it's the kind of thing you might want to throw in the background, but you're not going to sit there and watch it. It's not that kind of a film.
Yeah.
It's the kind of film where you pause and you listen to Mario Van Peebles, chew the scenery. And actually, the Shout Factory disc that this is on with three other films, actually, there's a commentary that Van Peebles does with, I think, the director. And
Wow.
that's kind of interesting to hear them talk about making the film. But I don't know. This one's really a hard call. I'm going to say I'm giving it 2.5 stars right there in the middle. If it sounds interesting or if that's something that you want to see, what the 84 version of the Exterminator is going to look like, check it out. If you want something thrown in the background, check it out. If you want to see, a good performance from Frankie Faison or, early Mario Van Peebles. And I just want to talk about Robert Ginty for a minute, because he was actually in one of my a film that I really like that people don't talk about, and that's The Paper Chase. Have you ever seen that?
It doesn't sound familiar. What is it?
He plays it's a 70s film. It's set in Boston. I think it's Harvard, and he's a first year law student. And it's about him making it through an incredibly tough law class. And Lindsay Wagner plays his girlfriend, and I think John Houseman is the let me pull it up, make sure I get this right. John Houseman, I think, plays the professor, And it's just, it's, I don't know what it is about the film I really like, but it just, you know, I watched it, you know, 10, 15 years ago, and I just really, really dug it. And there was a TV series that followed. Let's see here.
And Canon Films was really kind of, that was their thing. They would pick up things that existing properties and then just do sequels to them. Because they did Exterminator. They're famously known for the fact that they produced the Superman 4, is it? The Quest for Peace?
Yes.
They did a lot of sequels that they didn't do the first films. They didn't produce the first films. But they were notorious for just picking up properties and making sequels to them. But I also feel like this is a good drinking game movie. Like just taking Kayla Starr's all her one word reviews and every time someone dies by a flamethrower, you take a shot. Every time someone has crazy gel, you take a shot.
I take it back. Ginty was actually in the TV version of the movie, The Paper Chase. So he wasn't in the actual movie. That was Timothy Bottoms who played the main character in the film.
But
he was on the television series, which was also good.
Oh, okay.
So
you're going to give it 2.5 stars?
Sorry, go ahead.
You're going to give it 2.5 stars?
Yeah, I'm going to give it 2.5 stars. So.
All right. I'll stay out of this one because I didn't see it to completion. So there it is.
It's kind of like I said, it's kind of a mild recommend. It's the kind of thing that you can draw on in the background, and if you pick up that set that it's on, it's worth, you know, listening to the commentary or whatever.
Yeah, and Dan Gorman, who is also a podcaster blogger, I like his review too. It says Exterminator 2 is to Exterminator as Death Wish 3 is to Death Wish. And that makes a lot of sense too. It was kind of what I was saying, but.
So
that is the last movie of this episode. If you want to kind of be on the same track as we are, go ahead and get yourself these next films. We're gonna watch Ninja 3: The Domination will be the first one of our next episode. Let's see. Where am I? I don't want to lose my place. So we're going to start off with, excuse me, Ninja 3, The Domination, which definitely you want to watch because it's fun and it's kitschy and is a sequel to Revenge of the Ninja. That has an unofficial sequel. And then we're going to do Missing in Action and Missing in Action 2, The Beginning. So check both of those out. We're going to watch Breaking 2, Electric Boogaloo. Hopefully it's funnier than one, just because I expect it to. And then if we get a hold of The Ambassador, we're going to try to watch The Ambassador. And The Ambassador is a film that stars Robert Mitchum, Ellen Burstyn, Rock Hudson. So if we can get a hold of that, we're going to include that in the next episode. But for sure, Ninja 3, Missing in Action 1 and 2, Breaking 2, that'll be in our next episode. And then, so if you want to be in sync to the movies we're watching, check those out, and we will discuss them. I'd say this will post next week, which is the last week of February. So by the end of March, we'll do our next episode.
And we'll plan by the end of March. We have, you know, we keep saying that we'll do it in a month, but let's be honest, we've been taking a little bit longer.
But we're gonna
plan, but if it's a little longer.
Yeah, but also these first films were hard to find, so I had a hard time rewatching them. But a lot of these are going to be really easy because a lot of them are like, some of them are streaming, some of them are on Netflix. So I think it's going to go a lot smoother from now on. A lot of movies that I actually dig are coming up. So stay tuned. It's going to get really fun once we get into American Ninja and Bloodsport and Avenging Force and Masters of the Universe we'll be talking about hopefully soon. So it's going to get exciting. Stay tuned. You could find the podcast at The Film Podcast. You could find me on Twitter at Ricardo, ULTRERAS. You could find Eric at Iron Zero.
That's correct. On Twitter
On
and
Twitter.
on Letterboxd.
Yep. And then where can people, are you still updating your blog?
You know, I haven't been. I've been really lazy about that, unfortunately. So,
Okay, but people could.
the best place to find me is on Facebook. I'm on there pretty
Yeah.
constantly, so.
And if you don't, if you're like, what the hell did they say? What's their handles? Just go to our website and all Eric's stuff is in there. His Letterboxd handle, everything's on there. Just go to thefilmpodcast.com and all our information are on there. You could follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, and all that stuff. So go ahead and do that. And that's it. Any other parting
Yeah,
words of any of
can we
these
put in a
films?
quick plug for our
Yes.
buddy Morris and his new podcast, the See Here podcast, where they talk about movies that are about music?
Yes.
They just released their second episode, which features the film, Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains.
Yes.
And I believe the next film they're going to do is Prairie Home Companion. So
Oh.
that's worth a lesson, worth well worth checking out.
Yeah, I
So.
actually have to pick a film that I want to talk about. I think I'm going to be on it. I don't know. I think it's basically anything that has to do a film that has to do with music, right?
Yeah. So the first thing they did was the documentary Hated about the singer Gigi Allen, which obviously a film documentary. The second one, Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains, is a fiction piece. And, you know, Prairie Home Companion's kind of somewhere in the middle there because it is fiction, but it's about the show Prairie Home Companion. And so it's not a documentary, but it's not complete straight fiction either, so.
Yeah, that was a very interesting film. And was that Robert Altman's last film? It
It
was, right?
was, and I have a kind of an interesting story about it in that I was living in Minneapolis at the time that it was made, and my brother was really into, or was really into, Scandinavian humor records from that part of the country, from the 50s and 60s. There was a lot of kind of Scandinavian ethnic humor and comedy records, and they were trying to find the rights for some song they wanted to use in the movie. And one of the production people found my brother's little website about, you know, it was a real primitive website that was just talking about these few records. And we actually had a call on our answering machine because, like, my brother and I were living together in Minneapolis at the time. They wanted to talk to him to see if he knew who owned the rights to this song.
Oh, wow.
So, and he didn't. So I guess he called him back and said, yeah, I don't really know who owns the rights or whatever. Or he might have been able to point them towards somebody's great niece or something. But yeah, it was kind of funny. He's like, yeah, I got a call from the production assistant from Prairie Home Companion, so.
And that filmed in Minneapolis?
Yeah, they filmed it in or actually St. Paul,
Okay,
so right
wow.
next door, because that's where the show is based out of. And this would have been, I want to say, 2004 that this was, 2005, somewhere in there.
I once went to visit a friend in Fargo, and he said, "Hey, let's go get a burger." And then we went to St. Paul to get a burger.
Yeah, that
So,
sounds about right.
all right. So follow us. Tweet us any ideas you want us of films you want us to talk about in the future. Any other series you'd like to hear us talk about? We just did our Kathryn Bigelow episode. We talked about the work of Kathryn Bigelow, her film work, not her TV work, because she also has a lot of TV work.
Yeah, can I just quickly say, I'm a huge Kathryn Bigelow fan. I definitely think that The Hurt Locker deserved all the accolades. I love Zero Dark Thirty. But if you want to see her do something really interesting, go back and watch the episodes of Homicide: Life on the Street that she did. So good. So good.
How many did she do? Like, was it five or
I think she did
four?
two. She did.
Really? Just two?
I think it was just two.
Oh, wow. I thought she did a lot more than that. But no,
No, I,
you're
there
right.
was
You're
a.
right.
That show, which is one of my personal favorites, had a lot of film directors. Document, you know, Whit Stillman did an episode.
Oh, wow.
I mean, yeah, it was just really out of the box kind of stuff.
Whit
There's a
Stillman,
woman that did,
Last Days of Disco? Whit Stillman?
yeah, he did
Oh,
Last
okay.
Days of Disco and Barcelona and let me
Damsels
see
in
what other one.
Distress was his too, maybe?
Yep,
Oh, okay.
just give me one second here, and I'll look up exactly what she did. Kathryn Bigelow did on Homicide. I think she did the two episodes that involved involved actually a big shootout that was really good. Here we go. No, she did 3 episodes of Homicide: Life on the Street, Fallen Heroes Part 1 and 2, and Lines of Fire.
Oh, wow.
But that show, which, you know, if you like The Wire and you like Tremé, it's well worth going back and rediscovering this show. And like I said, the people, you know, the
directors that ended up directing that show, like you said, I didn't know what Stillman had done an episode.
Yeah, he did an episode. The woman who did Harlan County, USA, did an episode. Let's see. You know, Clark Johnson, who has become a well-known director, starred on the series but also directed an episode. John McNaughton directed. Let's see, Catherine Bigelow. Various of the stars of the series. Ted Demme did an episode. Barry Levinson, of course. Peter Weller. Is that the same Peter Weller?
I think it is.
Yes, it is. And actually, he did a really good episode of the new Hawaii Five-0 recently. Bruno Kirby directed an episode.
Oh, wow.
Jake and Maggie Gyllenhaal's father directed an episode. Kathy Bates directed an episode.
Kathy Bates?
You know, Whit Stillman. Yeah, wow. A lot of good people did work on that show.
Well, very cool.
Steve Buscemi directed an episode. Brad Anderson.
I've never seen it in its entirety.
Okay.
But well, it's definitely on my list of things to watch.
Definitely worth checking. It's like unlike anything you'll ever see anywhere else.
But like I said, if you guys want to check out the last episode, we cover all her film work. And we discuss. We started at The Loveless, which I wasn't.
I've never seen that one.
Yeah, it was really weird. So check that out. Follow us on Twitter and such. And until next time, hey, guys, have a good week.